Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And I wonder how many times you have been told to follow your passions, do what you love. That's the key to... What is it, the key to doing, actually, following what you love? Oprah says you do what you love. How is that different from being able to do whatever you want? Oprah can kind of do whatever she wants. What is the value of pep talks from billionaire legends like Steve Jobs and Oprah, lions of the motivational business? Am I doing what I love? If so, who cares? And if so, is this something I can take credit for, or have I been lucky, taking advantage of lots of opportunities, blasting through some earlier misery to be prepared to do what I'm doing now? You know, I have no idea, and I don't think about it that much. I generally think that the do what you love movement might not apply to everyone. I want to be a proctologist nurse or repair rain gutters, kill bed bugs. Do these avocations have lovers? Do you start from a place of gutter repair love and go for your dreams? Or maybe it's more like you're doing it, and after a while you get really good at it, and that becomes your passion, and then you love it. From Royal Oak, Michigan, one of you has this brilliant insight. I wanted to be an architect, but I've been turned off by the costs, the amount of time to become a professional, and the major adjustment I would have to make in my life, no prior training or experience. Well, you've learned there, Royal Oak. It's just not worth it. I get it. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE, and we'll talk more about doing what you love, or not, later this hour. And we'll also have a look at the musical soundtracks that coach you through those video games. Where do themes like Super Mario Brothers come from? We'll find out about that. But we begin at the end of the last episode of the saga we're going to call Clinton Abbey.
I am very proud to have been Secretary of State. But I leave this department confident. Confident about the direction we have set.
That's Hillary Clinton saying goodbye to her colleagues at the State Department after a stint that at the very least separated her from the failed presidential campaign and cleared the deck for a possible run for the presidency in 2016. Among those betting she will is the largest liberal super PAC, Priorities USA Action, already starting to raise money. But for a woman who has been in the White House before and has a list of allies that would fill a stadium, or six, the Clintons have a unique problem. Managing the players while keeping a tight team in control that can anticipate the issues and tactics of 2016 and not stumble on the memories and consequences of things that happened way back in 1998 or in 2008. Amy Chozick is a national political reporter for our partner, The New York Times, who covers Hillary Clinton. She has the cover story in this weekend's New York Times Magazine about the former Secretary of State. Amy, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
So you're beginning, it would seem, a fairly long journey here between now and the election, depending on the various decisions that need to be made by Hillary Clinton. Yes?
Yes, that's right.
And would you say that the Clintons have learned lessons from campaigns of the past, particularly 2008?
I think something you hear from particularly Hillary Clinton's people over and over again is that the State Department was run nothing like her chaotic 2008 campaign. It's something they kind of consistently want to remind reporters. And I think that's important because it tells, you know, it sends the message that she won't have the same managerial mishigas that sort of hurt her 2008 campaign.
So they definitely view her last episode as being Secretary of State, nothing to do with the 2008 campaign. That's ancient history. At least they want it to feel that way.
Exactly. They wanted to feel that way. But one thing that she learned about state that I touch on in the story is that, you know, during the campaign, there were a lot of cooks in the kitchen. The Clintons have been collecting friends, advisors, people who feel invested in her future for 40 years. And when she was at state, she was very cloistered off. And so she only had a tight-knit group of advisors around her. She was able to keep the noise out. And so I think now the question is, could she apply that to another campaign?
And that's really the question. It's a design question of how do you create a bubble without inviting in or alienating all of those people who have been loyal for 40 years? How are they doing that?
Exactly. I mean, I think it's something that they have to figure out. I mean, someone close to the Clintons said we've already discussed maybe having some kind of chief listener, you know, someone who makes these well-meaning loyalists feel heard, and some of their ideas will be great. But ultimately, a 2016 campaign is going to be run by 20 and 30-somethings who know how to manage data and all the kind of modern ways that presidential campaigns are waged. And so who can listen to those people, incorporate some of their ideas, but not let it become this complete, you know, just noisy battle?
And you suggest that there's an initiative already underway that some of the old guard Clinton loyalists are fairly suspicious of as kind of a make-work deal, a sort of sandbox for them to play in while the real work goes on by the 20-somethings.
Right. I mean, we're already seeing a couple super PACs emerge that have, you know, separate from what Secretary Clinton is doing, are sort of gearing up. And that's Ready for Hillary and that's Priorities USA. And those two have kind of sort of clashed. Priorities has said Ready for Hillary is a make work program for old Clinton loyalists. But then, you know, recently a lot of old Clinton loyalists have joined the board of Priorities. So there are already turf battles happening.
As you see these turf battles beginning, what's really going on here?
I think everybody is worried about their place in the world. I mean, one source drew a triangle for me on a cocktail napkin when I met him for coffee and said, the triangle is the Obama hierarchy. You know that the Obamas are on top. You know where you fall if you work for them. And the Clintons are very inclusive people. It's a circle. He drew a circle for the Clintons and he said, you know, that's great. It makes people feel very loved and part of the Clinton family, but it also creates a lot of not knowing where you stand. So I think it's an organizational issue that comes with the Clintons' style of embracing staff and aides and friends and collecting people. I mean, literally since Bill Clinton's kindergarten class.
Considering this notion of people who don't know where they stand, is it clear what role Bill Clinton will have in this campaign?
I think that's a good question. That was a big question in 2008. How do we utilize the former president? Obviously, he's our strongest surrogate, enormously popular. And that will be a question again, I'm sure.
And what about the role?
If there is a campaign.
Right, if there is a campaign. And what about the role of Chelsea? How has she emerged as a real player here?
Well, I think this is interesting. I mean, Chelsea has taken a real ownership role over the family's philanthropy and, you know, charitable work at their foundation. And the question is, would she also have sort of a leadership role in some kind of political campaign? I mean, right now, her aides and Secretary Clinton's aides say she is not involved in her mother's schedule or her mother's, you know, any kind of planning in her personal office. But she is a major presence in their lives now because she's taken over the family foundation.
How much of a personal stake, or is there any way to know at this point, does Hillary have in doing this right, in making whatever decision she makes as a real sort of legacy moment for what has been a career of public service?
I think it's absolutely vital, and you can't even look at it just for her legacy, but his own legacy. You know, another loss, what would that do to their philanthropic work? What would that do to his legacy? I think it's crucial right now that they try to figure out whether they can answer these questions.
Who's closest to them right now on that question of are they going to run? What is the legacy question? When do they step up?
Yeah, what's fascinating about Hillary is that she has developed a tight-knit group of aides who a lot of them worked with her in the White House. Some of them are not on her payroll now, but they talk to her all the time, and those include Cheryl Mills and Maggie Williams and Capricia Marshall, who was with her at the State Department, Huma Abedin, obviously. And these women all go back to Hillary land in the White House. So it's a long time that they've been together, and I think that they, you know, whether they think their boss should run or not, they are definitely invested in her doing what's right for herself and her legacy.
The folks closest to Hillary Clinton at the State Department were referred to by some as the Royal Council, I believe.
Well, one aide described them as the Royal Council, but I think I would put those longtime aides who were with her in the White House in that category. And then there's, you know, people like Philippe Reins, who is her kind of principal gatekeeper, who I write about in the piece. He would also be in there. And, you know, she has brought in new people.
Do the Clintons have a sense that the New York Times is sort of part of the Clinton message transferring machine, that the Times is sympathetic to the Clintons, is out to get the Clintons? It's going to be a sort of tough road to hoe in your journey with Hillary Clinton over the next year or so?
Well, it's a complicated question. I think that increased scrutiny, any candidate or potential candidate would not necessarily view that as, you know, a positive thing, especially particularly right now. Secretary Clinton sort of just wants to deliver her paid speeches and float under the radar. I mean, the second that she is viewed as a politician, she becomes much more polarizing. So I think there is a sensitivity to any kind of media scrutiny. I mean, that being said, you know, they do want to draw attention to some of her speeches about income inequality and universal pre-K and issues that she's been talking about.
And has anyone uttered the words vast right-wing conspiracy to date?
You know, you'd be surprised how many words come up, Whitewater, vast right-wing conspiracy, you know, impeachment, that were just decades ago, but those still come up.
Well, it's a part of why there's so much at stake in this campaign, because it's really an enormous chapter of U.S. history that's going to be played out.
Absolutely. And they're unlike any other political family. I mean, it's really fascinating.
Amy Chozick is national political reporter for our partner, The New York Times, covering Hillary Clinton. She has the cover story in this weekend's New York Times magazine. Congratulations, Amy. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.